But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello, I'm very pleased to be joined today by not one, but two fund managers in the studio, Lansdowne Partners, Jonathan Regis and Nigel Hickmit. Both are portfolio managers on the Lansdowne Developed Markets Fund, which is part of the $5 billion developed market strategy at the firm. Jonathan, Nigel, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us today.
Jonathan, I'm going to start with you, as you've been at Lansdowne for the kind of the full span of this question I'm about to ask. You joined in 2003, and when it comes to the developed markets team, for about 10 years, you were running a long-short fund, and then about another 10 years, you were running a long-only fund alongside that. Now you're focusing on the long-only. Can you talk me through that evolution a bit?
Yeah, so and the first thing to say is we actually ran the long-short fund for 20 years.
For 20 years, yeah.
Yeah, and then I've run the long-only fund since. I think the most important thing to say is that we sit down as a team quite often to think about what the most compelling investments are for the next 10 years. And what we try to do is align that thought with our products, because ultimately that's what's best for our clients. Those views don't change that often, but when they do, it's normally during some kind of dislocation in the market. So the first time of that, we were all running, we were running long-only funds at what was Mercury Asset Management at the time, in the dot-com bubble. And we looked around and we thought, well, there's a lot of mispricing here. Some things are extremely expensive, as you can imagine, but other things were missing out on the dot-com bubble and were very cheap. So we could see this opportunity on both the long and short side of the balance sheet. So that's why we set up the hedge fund in 2001, actually before I came. And then the next sort of dislocation, I guess, was the global financial crisis. And during that period, really coming out of it the other side, when we sort of sat down and thought about what are the investment opportunities, our view was that actually the market had just got too cheap. And there were some really high quality businesses in the world, normally sort of growth businesses linked to the sort of consumer internet or the mobile internet. Well, we thought there were just really huge growth opportunities and they were just too cheap. So we said, well, we need to launch a long-only fund to take advantage of that. That's what we did. It eventually got launched in 2012. And the very first investments we made were things like Amazon and Google, Visa, Nike, Colgate, Coca-Cola. So it was very much a global large cap long-only fund. And then the last sort of big, I guess, dislocation was during COVID. And when Pete and I sat down, Pete, the head of our team, we were sitting there discussing, you know, what is it about what we're doing right now that we think is good? And we thought, well, the long side is extremely cheap, and especially things that have been impacted by COVID. So the airlines, the banks, the building materials were obviously all doing very badly during that period. And we were very excited about the opportunity there. But on the short side, we were thinking it was very hard to actually find enough single stock shorts to make a portfolio. So at that time we thought, well, on that basis, we
probably... And there was also a sense that while some things were very cheap, lots of the market just kept going up.
Exactly. So we just thought, well, if that's the scenario, and we ended up with things like GameStop, obviously, which we didn't hold, but there's some really tough shorting environment at that time. So we decided that it was time to close the hedge fund and focus on where we thought the real opportunity was, which was on the long-only side. And to be honest, to date, I think that's been the right decision. We closed it in October 2020. We tried to get as many people across to the long-only fund from the hedge fund as possible. And since that date, it's been 4 years now. The long-only fund has compounded at about 16% since that date. So I think that's probably a lot better than we would have done in the hedge fund, and actually above the index as well. So we've been very happy with that decision so far. So it's really... I guess the conclusion is we're trying to focus on where we think the best opportunities are. It's no longer the short side.
You're enjoying having that focus?
Yeah. No, we very much enjoyed being long only product at the moment.
Okay. And so you launched the UCITS funds approaching £100 million in December last year, Nigel. I mean, can you tell me a bit about that, how it's different to what you do otherwise?
Sure. So that actually, about 3 years ago, one client just asked us to run a daily dealing version of our product for them. And we decided to broaden it out to to more clients almost a year ago, as you suggested. So it's now actually well through 100 million.
Okay.
The nice thing for us is it really is a core expression of our views. It's 70 to 80% identical to kind of the core strategy. We're able to get all of our views across, and I think it's hopefully something that we can offer that's distinct and very active in this market, and maybe a trend for the next decade as we look at the appropriate products, is things that used to be behind, you know, I guess almost an institutional paywall,
right,
opening up to a broader audience. So hopefully that's something we can offer.
Hedge funds even launching ETF versions
exactly.
of their products, that
exactly.
kind of thing. Yeah, quite different. And Jonathan, just returning to you, I mean, yeah, what makes your kind of process different? And what do you feel your edge is?
So we are fundamental bottom-up stock pickers.
Mm-hmm.
We generally take a sort of 3 to 5 year view in shares and invest in developed market equities. So our typical day is based around meeting management of companies, analyzing companies, trying to understand the economics of a business to spot valuation opportunities.
Yeah.
But if asking exactly what our edge is, normally what we found over time is that it's spotting some kind of change.
Mm.
And it's a change that the market is not appreciating. And that change can be really quite wide ranging, from things like consolidation in the industry or a lack of supply in the industry, meaning that company now has pricing power that it didn't have before.
Yeah.
It can be some kind of demand inflection, or it can be something more internal, like a reason why margins might be going up or asset turn might be improving. So there's a sort of wide range of changes that we look at. But what's key is that we find a change which isn't appreciated by markets, and therefore we have a differentiated view on the company's valuation. And for us, valuation is very, very important. So what we're not just saying is we find a business that's changing, we buy it. We have to find a business that's changing. Well, when we look at the valuation, that change is not in the price.
Okay.
And that's when we buy it. And I guess the only other thing I'd say about this is that we end up being very style agnostic.
Mm.
So some people try to say, oh, you're a value, are you a growth fund? But the reality is, as I touched on earlier, in 2012, if you came to us, we were 70 to 80% in the US. And we've very much had a growth bias, as I touched on with the Google and the Amazons and the Visas, etc. If you look at our fund today, we're 20 to 30% in the US and very much with a value bias. So the important thing is where those changes are also changes over time.
Yeah.
So it changes a lot. Exactly. So it's not just a case of we look for changes in value. It's really a case of where do we see the changes that the market's not appreciating, and that's where we invest.
Yeah. And, you know, you're, as you say, you're bottom-up stock pickers. You're not kind of thematic investors, so to speak. But the process does seem to lead you to focus on a few kind of clusters of ideas in a way. Can you talk me through, headline view of 3 or 4 of those maybe?
Yeah.
30 seconds on each, if possible. Although it might be too complicated.
Okay. So, I mean, I think the most important thing is we want to be exposed to what we think are the growth dynamics of the next decade.
Yeah.
And what's important is we think that's very different to the last decade. So if you look at the stock market, and most people will know this, over the last 10 years, all the winners have been the sort of capital light, sort of tech companies, growth companies, quality compounders, normally based in the US. And the sort of the losers of the last 10 years have been what we like to call the forgotten equities.
Okay.
The banks, the building materials, the
yeah.
resources, the paper and packaging companies, the sort of old economy, capital intensive businesses. What we find really interesting at the moment is when you look at those capital light businesses that have all been winning, what's happened is, of course, if they've been investing a lot of money trying to grow over the last few years with their very low cost of equity. And what we're worried about now is we're seeing a lot of examples of those businesses that have done very well for the last 10 years now seeing a lot of competition. And as an example, I said earlier, we owned Nike, and obviously that took huge advantage of when the consumer internet became big.
Mm.
But what's happened recently is the likes of TikTok and social media means you can advertise more easily. Direct distribution means you need fewer shops. And suddenly they're having to compete with On and Castore and Gymshark and Hoka, and they're losing market share. The same thing's happening for Lululemon. The same thing's happening for Starbucks,
okay.
The amount of independent coffee companies. The same thing's happening at Google, where we're seeing surveys that the Gen Z are actually using TikTok as their number one search engine. And we're seeing it at Chinese EVs taking market share. And then lastly, we're obviously seeing it in places like, seeing a slowdown at least, in places like food consumption. That might be a Zempic, or it might be people mm-hmm. thinking more about their health. And in alcohol, where, again, the Gen Zs are clearly drinking less alcohol than the generations before them. So a lot of these growth companies of the past, we think, are now either slowing or seeing new competition. On the other hand, what we're trying to invest is where we think the growth is for the next 10 years.
Right.
So this is things like the reshoring and the deglobalization that's going on, the energy transition, the amount of money we need to spend on defense post-Ukraine, the amount of money we need to spend on housing, especially here in the UK, right. The sort of digitalization and automation of industry, which is way behind the consumer, the aging infrastructure and the amount of capital we need to spend on that. And then lastly, things like hardware to do with AI. So a lot of CapEx spending going on in developed markets. So when we look at the fund overall, what we're saying is, right, we want to be exposed to those growth areas, but in areas where there isn't new competition and new supply. Okay. So that often leads to those forgotten equities we're talking about. And that's why we end up clustering, because it is, where do we get at that exposure? We think it's in building materials. We think it's in banks. Mm. We think it's in certain electrification plays. So we end up with these clusters because you get that demand growth that we really expect for the next 10 years, but without the supply and competition of the areas where we're a little bit worried that there's going to be pressure.
Yeah. Okay, Nigel, I'm going to bring you back in, because it's not all about forgotten equities. I mean, you mentioned AI, Jonathan.
Yes.
And TSM, you know, you've trimmed but still hold Amazon, and TSMC is actually your biggest position, whopping, around 8.5% in the UCITS fund. I mean, talk me through that, how that kind of fits in then.
Sure. Well, if you think about new demand in the world, one of the biggest sources of new spend or growth in spend is the pursuit of advances in machine intelligence, right? And to put it in context, you know, what I would look at as the global tech titans, over the last several years, they've added a FTSE 100 in terms of CapEx growth, right? And that's a reasonably capital-intensive industry index, as you'll recall. So a lot of spend growth that we want to have access to. And I think when we think about where we can capture that value, it's a bit harder for us to have an edge on which specific chip they're investing in and whether that chip lead will hold. But the one thing we do know is they're almost entirely being made at the leading edge at one place.
Right.
And increasingly, it seems to us from a competitive perspective, the competitors for TSM at the leading edge are dropping out of that race. So you've got a much more platform way of accessing the growth in that spend. And the key change for us that we've been very focused on has really been the shift from one anchor tenant at TSM to many. Right. So previously, your business really had Apple with iPhones driving the leading edge of compute. Apple is a massive customer and pretty hard to have as your biggest single customer.
Right.
What we see today is a real expansion to the likes of NVIDIA, kind of AMD with GPUs, but also the internal chip programs at all of the largest tech players in the world. Those chips that could retail for, you know, $50,000 have a lot more gross profit in them than an iPhone for $1,000. So over time, we think TSM can capture some of that value. You know, this is a business that has compounded its growth at close to 20% since its IPO. We think it's growing about 30% right now. We think its margins can grow because of some of this pricing power. You add that all up, it's one of the most important companies in the world, and it's trading on a discount to the index a few years out. That seems pretty attractive. But I guess whilst that is the us capitalizing on that growth in spend, we've also done a lot of work, and a lot of perhaps the more interesting areas that we're focused on right now is where that AI is going to impact the real economy and real businesses. I don't know if do you want to touch on any of that?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess, like I was saying earlier, what we're trying to look for is the growth where, as yet, it's not appreciated by markets. And
right.
I think there's two real good examples of that we're looking at the moment. One is in the analog semiconductor businesses, where what we see is, a few years ago, there was this big promise about us all having smart cities, smart buildings, smart factories, and smart traffic, etc. And it never really happened. Our view is that AI is the catalyst to make those kind of things happen. And, you know, our traffic lights still will have chips on them and actually be green at the right time rather than the wrong time. And these things will become smart, and our buildings will be smarter about how to heat, etc., etc. And all of that will create this big sort of Internet of Things market. If we then include things like health monitors that I'm wearing today, and also robotics, you know, these humanoid robots have up to sort of 200 analog chips in them, and also autonomous driving. We just think the market for analog chips, because of AI, over the next sort of cycle will be much bigger than the market expects, and go on much longer. The other area is healthcare. And clearly, we think AI, you know, healthcare is one of the biggest changes because of AI, I think, or one of the markets that's going to change the most because of AI. It's going to become a lot more personalized, a lot more around genomics. And one thing we already know that AI is pretty good at in healthcare is looking at scans and helping radiologists, you know, look for sort of heart problems or whatever it happens to be. Our view is that over time, what's going to happen is, rather than us go to the doctor when we're feeling ill and we've got a problem or a chest pain or whatever it happens to be, and getting a CT or an MRI scan to see what's happened. Mm. What we'll do is we'll look into our genomics. We know I'm more likely to have sort of neurological problems, as an example, and I will go once every 6 months for a checkup to see if there's any potential problems happening. So A, to see if I've got a problem, and B, to see if they can sort it out much earlier.
Okay.
That means the use case for scans will go up a lot from here. So we've invested in some businesses that are exposed to those MRI and CT scanners on the basis of the growth in AI over the time.
All right. Thanks, Jonathan. I mean, yes, sort of moving on from AI. I mean, we've kind of touched on it, but your fund basically looks totally different to the global market. I mean, not the most scientific data in some ways, but, you know, you've got about 30% of the portfolio plus in the UK, which, as we know, is increasingly different to the global index. But actually, performance since you launched the UCITS fund has been quite similar to the global market. You've kept up, really. I guess, what's driven that? What's been working well for you in these value areas that have been a bit neglected by others?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you're right. The fund's almost never looked this different to the index.
Yeah. So, ironically, in your first year, performance is quite close.
Yes, yeah. I mean, slightly ahead today. And we've got, you know, that's really been driven by the two bookends of the portfolio, actually.
Okay.
So it's really the deep value end on the banks side of things. Those are kind of UK and Irish retail banks, typically. And, you know, on average, they're up kind of north of 50%. And then actually that other side of the portfolio as well, those semiconductors, electrification, et cetera,
right,
also driving a lot of performance. So,
okay,
so it's kind of, it's been quite mixed. I think if you step back a little bit, you know, our process clearly doesn't start at the index, right, as you've heard. So I think what we think is encouraging is the companies we own today are capable of this kind of double-digit return over the medium term, we think, every year. And that's because their earnings are growing, they're chucking off a lot of cash, they're buying back a lot of stock. And when you start with a fund on 11 times earnings for businesses that we think are actually pretty high quality and growing, you've actually got a call option on top of that of, actually, should they really be trading this cheap? So actually, maybe it can do a bit better. And in a year where perhaps the index isn't driven by the tailwind of a few companies, we would hope that the fund can still perform quite well as well. So if we can keep up with it in years where it does, and hopefully we can keep up with, you know, outperform it as well in years where it doesn't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And on kind of banks, I don't know which of you is better place to take this, but yeah, I mean, you know, as a kind of theme, or, well, that's just holdings, you know, it's about a quarter of the portfolio.
Yep.
So it's a lot, really. I mean, what change are you seeing there that others are missing?
So I think the main one is that I think it's pretty clear that most people think banks are bad businesses that don't grow.
Okay.
The average bank that we own is on about 1x book and about 6 or 7x earnings. So those multiples don't suggest that people think that they're either quality businesses or growth businesses. We think they are both quality business and businesses that will grow.
Mm.
So quite a big change in the market narrative, I think, coming. And so I guess breaking that down, why do we think they're good businesses? So firstly, I think the barriers to entry in banking are actually extremely high. In my career, we've had a number of businesses trying to break into banking, be that right from Egg to Metro Bank and Starling Bank, all the supermarkets, Virgin, and none of them have really gained a huge amount of traction because the barriers to entry are just very hard. People do not move their current account that often. And at the same time, we're actually seeing consolidation. So this year, we've seen Tesco's, Sainsbury's, Virgin and Co-op all get bought. So unlike some of the things I was talking about earlier, here we're seeing supply being consolidated and high barriers to entry rather than lots of new competition coming in. And at the same time, why else are they good businesses? Well, their returns, the average one of the businesses we own returned over 15% return on equity in the last quarter. And that includes these big structural hedges these businesses are taking out against interest rates. That over time will cause a tailwind because those structural hedges will roll off, and actually underlying the returns are actually substantially above that 15% return. So starting point is the businesses are making good returns and have high barriers to entry. Then when we look about, well, can they grow? I mean, the starting point for that is, well, one's got to remember that NatWest had £2 trillion worth of assets in 2007.
Okay.
Today it's got 700 billion. So we have been through a massive reduction in these businesses. They've really been shrinking. So the market's definitely not thinking about these businesses as growth businesses. But in the most recent quarter, both AIB in Ireland said that they'd seen the strongest loan growth, I think it was for 15 to 16 years, and are predicting sort of 5 to 6% loan growth. NatWest are saying they're seeing the green shoots of loan growth. It's not a surprise to me that we're seeing loan growth when we talk about the amount of spending we need on housing and all the things we talked about earlier.
Yeah.
So what we see is a little bit of loan growth, 5% of AIB, maybe less in the UK ones. But if you add together that structural head I talked about earlier and how that's going to come back and buybacks, we see well into the double digit earnings growth for these banks for the next 5 years, as well as them paying a dividend. So we think they are high quality growth businesses.
And how does that compare to what most analysts think?
Is, I mean, that a lot more one times optimistic? Book and six, seven times earnings will tell you something else. And,
right.
and what Pete keeps reminding me at work is that the last time the market thought that Lloyds was a high quality business that could grow was in 1998. And although I had to check this because I couldn't believe it, at that time it actually traded on 7 times book, in fact, 7.7 times book,
okay.
And 25 times earnings. So whilst I'm not predicting to any stretch that Lloyds gets to that valuation, the upside, if you think about how the market's currently pricing it on one times book and 6 times earnings, when it used to trade on 7.5 times book and 25 times earnings,
yeah.
It's pretty substantial. So okay. we don't think it's going to get there, but you know, if the market does change its view on it, it can be a growth business with some quality behind it and making good returns. We think there's still a lot of upside to these banks.
Okay, yeah.
Hence their accord of the portfolio.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's Pete Davis, your kind of long-time colleague at Lansdowne, you mentioned there. I suppose I'm going to try and tie together a couple of questions at once here. I mean, you know, take NatWest. I mean, the shares have actually performed very well over the last year, as has TSMC, for example, for very different reasons. I mean, you mentioned that the portfolio can change a lot over time, depending on where you're seeing opportunities. I suppose, yeah, how do you know when it's kind of time to pull the plug on these themes, these ideas you've been looking at? I mean, do you use price targets? Is it, how do you know when to make these shifts in the portfolio?
It's a very good question. Normally, it's when we feel like we don't have that differentiation anymore.
Okay.
If we think, look, we're seeing this change, but the market sees this change, the valuation tells us that change is now in the price.
Mm.
That's when we feel like we don't have that differentiated view, and that's normally when we part ways with the investments we make. And you know, that can be right or wrong. Quite often, in the past, what's happened is we've sold a share which has then gone on continued to grow, normally because it gains some kind of momentum or potentially gets overvalued.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, what we're very keen that we can understand the valuation, that what we're seeing is more than priced in, and that we think there's upside. And when that no longer happens, we sell the shares.
Yeah. I'd say we're definitely long term, but not inert.
Mm.
You know, a good example would be we've got a tiny weighting in oil today in the fund. Post Ukraine, that went from 0 to 15% very quickly.
Right.
So quite happy to put our chips in where we think there's good risk reward, and it's come all the way back down again.
Right.
So you see.
You kind of sold it right back down quite recently.
Exactly. Right? And TSM, you know, last autumn went from 0 to our biggest position in a matter of months, right?
Okay.
So where we do see real opportunity and real differentiation, we're quite happy to move quite substantially.
Yeah. We mentioned this 30% plus UK weighting. And you know, you said when we were chatting the other day, you know, you're not about making these big macro calls, really, or even, you know, you might not have all that much to say about things like the budget or the government, that kind of thing. But I guess, yeah, if we can step back a bit, I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk about kind of concentration risk in markets and this kind of amazing 70%, you know, weighting that the US has got up to. I suppose, yeah, kind of the UK, Europe, I mean, clearly there's a lot of malaise, you know, on this whole continent.
Yeah.
What's going to change that? Or is that too hard to answer in one?
I mean, actually, so I think there's a number of things. I mean, the first thing is just after a while, the valuations become too cheap. And what we found with the banks, at least, and because they were too cheap for a number of years before they started working, is that when they really actually started working was when the banks got to the position where they could actually start buying back their own capital.
Okay.
So one way of doing it is saying, look, we're on a very cheap multiple, and therefore we'll start doing large buybacks, and that seems to when equity holders get the cash back, that can affect it.
Right.
Another way is we've seen M&A transactions move up a lot in the UK this year, and sort of last way, I think probably Nigel's the expert on it, is this sort of relisting that we've seen.
Yeah,
That's it. There have been.
We've had many.
We've had many. Can you talk about that a bit?
Yeah. So I think the you know, at its core, companies don't just stand still, right? And I think so we've had. Probably in the last several years, we've had three big ones in CRH, Flutter, and Smurfit Westrock. You know, one way or another, finding a listing in the US, we've probably got one other position that's evaluating it publicly right now.
Okay.
I think ultimately, if a company is making more than 50% of its profits in a market where those profits are being given double the multiple, Companies are very incentivized to go pursue that.
And you support that as well?
Look, we're global investors, and we're happy to look anywhere and look at anything. You know, just because we don't have a huge weighting in the US today doesn't stop the fact that I'm there every quarter looking for new companies, new opportunities. So one has to always be kind of aware and open open to those themes.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I mean, it's something that causes kind of a lot of hand-wringing in city circles. But
sure.
I suppose, yeah, as fund managers, it's if it gets better for returns for you,
yeah.
you don't mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
No. And it's what brings, you know, this cheap discount of the UK and Europe is what brings the opportunities. I mean,
yeah.
when we see things like IAG, which is the owner of British Airways, trading on 5x earnings, and yet with assets which we think are almost impossible to replicate, they own more than half the slots at Heathrow, and we think those earnings are growing, and yet trading on 5x, you know, those kind of things don't last forever.
Mm.
So we just think that this is what's creating the opportunity. As I said before, in 2012, we had 70% of our assets in the US.
Right.
But today it's 25%. So there's quite a big move, and that's because where we're seeing the opportunities, as I talked about before, is normally in those forgotten equities, the cheaper equities. Guess what? They're mainly based in Europe and UK, not the US.
Yeah.
So which I guess isn't a surprise, but we really think that but for reasons that Nigel just talked about and other reasons, we just think that's going to last forever.
Yeah, and I thought, you know, last investment question to finish on that might be interesting was. Yeah, as we said, until quite recently, you're running a long short fund. I mean, you know, I get a really strong sense of enthusiasm from you guys about your stocks, about your themes. I mean, do you think it's kind of freed you up in a way, just focusing on the long only side?
Yeah, I mean, in some ways. I mean, I enjoy looking at both sides of the balance sheet. But I mean, what's true to say is, in this market, I'd say running shorts is particularly difficult because you can't have big positions in shorts, and therefore to be a true hedge fund with, you know, a low net, you would need a lot of positions. In the short. So it is nice to be able to say, well, hang on, we don't need a lot of positions in the
right.
We can have up 35, 45, that kind of range of names. And yes, we can look at the rest of the world, but we can really concentrate on these businesses, get to know them really well and invest in them. And yes, so in some ways it's quite nice. You know, if we had to have 60 or 70 shorts on top of that and be looking at 100 companies at once that we've invested in, it would probably be a lot more stressful job.
Gotcha.
So
yeah. For you, Nancy.
Yeah, look, if you wrap it all up, I think there is a lot of optimism. You know, what we're suggesting is you've got a world that's about to have a massive investment cycle with a lot of new intelligence, and that could actually be really productive.
Okay.
You know, that could get us out of some of the malaise economically we've been in for the last 15 years. So I think, you know, when you get an opportunity at buying that and starting on a really cheap valuation, you know, I think what's not to be excited about?
That's a really good point Nigel makes. One of the things we didn't talk about in AI, because it's more of a sort of global thing, is that if it's true, and it looks possible that it will be, that the cost of intelligence falls dramatically because of AI, and then through autonomous driving and robotics, the cost of labour also falls to almost zero, then I think the sort of productivity benefits that's going to bring the world will almost be more exciting than the tech investments you can make in AI. Those kind of, you know, if we really do get the productivity benefits that a falling of the cost of labour and cost of intelligence will bring,
right.
then concerns
It'll
in
totally
the market,
reshape.
Like, yeah, totally reshape everything, and all the concerns we currently have about debt to GDP, for example, will be things in the rearview mirror.
Mm.
So there's a really optimistic world out there if AI works as well, which I think is an interesting one.
Yeah, and we'll just finish with a kind of quick non-fund management one. I mean, yeah, what do you guys both like to do when you're outside the office? Who wants to start? Slightly nervous giggles.
Yeah. You know, I've got a family with three young kids that takes up most of my time, to be honest. So
okay.
When I'm not working, that's all I'm doing, really.
Yeah, the same thing. I like spending my time with my family. What else do we like doing? We're both unfortunately Tottenham fans.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay.
So we like watching sport and normally getting beaten.
Yeah.
And generally, yeah, like watching sport and spending time with family. That's
well,
the
to be a Tottenham fan, you've got to be an optimist.
Yeah, exactly. This maybe is where it comes from.
Maybe that's a good note to finish on. So,
for
yeah,
sure.
Anyway, thanks both so much for coming in today. Yeah, very, very good to talk more about what you do.
Lovely. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The crowned queen waves from the Bell.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929. The Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.